Talking Books on News Talk 106 to 108.
What we're finding, not just that study, but studies across the board, is that becoming the most connected humans in history has had no positive effects on levels of loneliness. If anything, we're actually more lonely than we were before. And you know, and this was such an important revelation for me when I began working on this book, that it turns out that the cure for loneliness is not more company, right? The cure for loneliness is learning how to be alone. And I think this is a big mistake that we're all making together. When you're lonely in a grocery store lineup for 20 seconds, instead of spending that time daydreaming or thinking about a loved one, we dive into our phone because we can't handle even a little bit of it. And, you know, I think most mental faculties require a kind of exercise, and very much so when it comes to spending time alone. We have to practice spending time alone. We'll feel uncomfortable at first, but it's something that you get better at, and there are benefits. It's just like going to the gym. It feels horrible the first few times you do it.
One can be instructed in society. One is only inspired by solitude. The perceptive words of German writer and scholar Johann Wolfgang von Goethe. Hello, how are you? And you're very welcome to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. What is solitude? How do we find it? And what are the benefits? Well, on tonight's show, we're going to unpack those questions with Canadian writer and journalist Michael Harris, whose latest book, Solitude, In Pursuit of a Singular Life in a Crowded World, has just been published by Random House. Where Michael argues, solitude is refreshing. It makes us calmer, more attentive, clear-headed. Most of all, it relieves the pressures of conformity. It gives us the space we need to discover the deepest sources of passion, enjoyment, and fulfillment in our lives. So, why is something so simple so challenging? And is it possible to log out, power down, and switch off?
So, my name's Michael Harris. I'm the author of two books of nonfiction. The first was called The End of Absence, and that's all about what it means to be the last generation that remembers life before the internet. And my most recent book is called Solitude, which is a kind of extension of the first book's ideas. It's looking at what is the value of solitude and absence and daydreaming, all those qualities of life that we seem to have put to one side as we charge online.
Really, okay. Well done on the book, Michael. I have to say it's very very poetic and very inspiring in parts. And you bring up so many different interesting questions. You cover so much ground. It's really, really well done. Listen, I'm going to throw you a big wide open question to kick things off and show we can take it from there. Do you think a lot of us are afraid of our own company, afraid of our own skin, so to speak?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's where this book came from for me. I've just moved with my partner to Toronto. And I didn't know anybody in that city. It's a really big city. And I was spending my life working at home, and I was very lonely. I wasn't used to that level of loneliness. Even within a city, it's possible to be very lonely, I think. And that's where I began thinking about, I guess, the difference between being lonely and experiencing solitude itself. I wanted to figure out how to be alone in a healthy way instead of always feeling as though I was somehow failing at being alone.
Can I throw you a philosophical question, Michael? Do you think we're ever fully alone? I know you write somewhere, to be happily alone is to affirm one's fate in the love of others. And that line really got me thinking that, you know, we're alone with our memories, but we're in relationship with our memories. We're in relationship with our plans for the future. And we're always carrying around stories about ourselves. So in ways we are armed with ourselves and our stuff, but are we really, really alone?
Absolutely. I mean, like everything else, the question of solitude is a question of spectrums, right? And I think that, you know, the funny thing about spectrums is sometimes they come back around on their own ends. So the person who's really happily alone usually is only able to experience that that rich solitude because they feel so connected to the world around them. If you don't feel connected to the world around them, then you fall into a kind of loneliness and you're desperately searching for those connections constantly. So yes, I mean, if you're happy sitting on a bench watching the ocean for a few hours, it's probably because you have beautiful, rich relationships in your life and you can draw on those relationships as a kind of psychological reserve.
Do you think as time spent alone, whether it's for a couple of hours or a couple of days or whatever, can make everybody more calmer in some way? Do you think it's for everyone that they have a kind of a proper spin-off from things?
Well, I think it varies, absolutely. Some people are naturally introverted and without some time alone in every day, they'll actually feel exhausted. They can't really mentally handle it. Others don't get their energy from time alone. They get it from interacting with other people. But I would say that even those extroverts are missing some component of a full, rich life if they don't explore their solitude a little. But to your point, I think some people have more to gain from time alone than others, and we all have to design our own solitude diet, depending on how it works for us, I think.
Now, everybody's route into solitude or an aspect of solitude is very, very, very different. And I suppose the stories that come with that. But you bring up a very inspirational story of a lady called Dr. Edith Bowen. And she had a very traumatic introduction to solitude. She was in 7 years solitary confinement in Hungary. And how she kept herself going was so unbelievably remarkable, and her mental resilience. And it struck me, though, that there's only so many Dr. Edith Bowens in the world who can actually live and prosper and flourish while being so alone and so removed from all aspects of life.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Dr. Bowen is a kind of a hero character for the book. I tell her story in the prologue, not because I envy her circumstances. I don't think that most of us become better people for solitary confinement, but because I envied her faculties. The fact, I mean, most people, as you say, become depressed and anxious with even a week of solitary confinement. This was a woman who could spend 7 years alone, and because she entered that prison sentence with such rich mental faculties, she was able to survive it with her sanity intact. So she was really a point of inspiration for me when I was first doing research for this book. I wanted, again, not to experience what she'd experienced, but to figure out what was it in her life, in her time, in her mind that gave her that kind of a strength, which I seem to be so lacking.
It's amazing to think that we all have the capacity to some degree of being able to live within our imaginations. And when you apply that to the challenges that any life faces, whether it's marital separation, whether it's grief, trauma, sick children, whatever it is, to be able to allow yourself a moment in the day just to live within your imagination in order to keep yourself going. It's a beautiful idea, isn't it?
Yes. I think we tend to think of those moments alone as luxuries nowadays. But the more I read about the history of solitude and the research that's coming out now about what solitude does to our minds, the more I started to think of it as a kind of healthy mental food that we've been depriving ourselves of. Similar to the 1950s in North America, where we were all eating nothing but canned food and bright orange cheese, and organic meat would have been considered a kind of obscene luxury. Nowadays, we think of it as just sort of living a healthy life. My hope is that the next generation coming up will start to see breaks in their media-saturated days as a kind of necessary step in having a healthy mental life.
You recommend cultivating your inner weirdo, and that made me laugh so hard because I kind of thought to myself, well, I'm probably pretty good at my outer weirdo, but my inner weirdo, how do I go about that?
Cultivating the inner weirdo. So that comes from a section that's looking at where we get our, how we decide what we like, what we love, what we want to do. There's been a lot of talk nowadays about this idea of a filter bubble. So when you go online, there are algorithms that are determined to get you clicking on things, and those algorithms are not interested in getting you to explore exciting or weird new things. They're going to give you more and more of the things you already know that you like. So it creates a kind of re-inscription of the biases you already have, and it produces a kind of a deadening of curiosity, I think. The idea of cultivating that inner weirdo is to, instead of looking for approval through retweets or likes on Facebook, you know, maybe run your hands down a bunch of books at a library and let something a little bit more chaotic or accidental inform the fruits of your curiosity.
Michael, you pitch up a very interesting question on the value of daydreaming, and you kind of explore what that does to you on an emotional, psychological, and I suppose a spiritual level as well. What's your own view, aside from the book? Do you think we do enough of it?
I don't, no, because, again, I don't think we have faith in things that aren't immediately giving us results, right? Daydreaming is actually a very powerful mental activity. When you daydream, your brain activates something called the default mode network. And neuro research recently has been looking at how active that daydreaming brain actually is. It's where all those eureka moments come from. When you're waking up and not really thinking about much and having a shower, and suddenly you realize the answer to the problem you were puzzling over all last night, it's because you're allowing your brain to relax, daydream, and do some work without the interfering ego that thinks it knows how to puzzle through something, right? So there's something very useful about building that silent mental time into your day. It's not just a luxury. It's actually something incredibly practical, it turns out, to, you know, have a cup of coffee and stare out the window. So we think of these things as time wasters, and we want to be productive. We're trained very much. I don't know about Ireland, but certainly in North America, we're very much trained to make everything pragmatic and results oriented. But all through our schooling, I feel like that's flexing just one set of the brain's muscles, whereas daydreaming is this whole other set of brain muscles that we sometimes don't exercise.
Yeah, you had a very interesting piece in the book with Dr. Kalina Kristoff. I think she runs the UBC Cognitive Neuroscience of Thought Lab in Vancouver. And I hadn't heard much about her, and I looked her up, and she seems like an unbelievably interesting woman. But she said something to you on the lines of that our culture puts a premium on control in all things. And she, you know, she gave you lots of different stats on, you know, the power of the wandering mind. But she really has a point, because in a lot of ways we live very busy lives, very scheduled lives, and all aspects of that lead into control and trying to control everything. And it has to have a massive impact on our cognitive functions at the end of the day, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I live in Vancouver, so I was lucky enough that I had some proximity to Kalina and her lab. I think you hit the nail on the head. This is something that really affects our cognitive function. If we don't make room for daydreaming, we're not using our whole brain, right? And that's a real tragedy when you think of it.
And when you think that through and look at the kind of the next stages from that, that I would imagine would lead into issues with problem solving and trying to get your head around even some very simple tasks that kind of demand of you to either think critically or to independently think in some way and to problem solve and go deep within yourself to figure the answer. And sometimes that takes time. Sometimes you can do it quite instantly. But it's an aspect of how we use our brain. And you can't lead into if you're trying to constantly control every situation you're walking into.
Precisely. And the other thing that, of course, daydreaming does is it forces you to be thinking outside of the crowd, right? So much of our thinking these days is happening online. It's happening on social media. And that creates a kind of follow the leader effect, right? Whereas to really know what you think, yes, you have to go to the crowd and listen to what they say. You have to go to hopefully some authorities and listen to what they say as well. And then you do have to step away from the crowd and process those things on your own. One of the things that I spent some time on in the book is looking at great scientists and great artists and the way that they designed a practice of thinking into their lives. Where they were connected to other humans, of course, where they were gathering information as much as they could, but every hour that you would spend talking with others would always require a certain amount of time off on your own, puzzling through things. And I think that's something that a lot of us these days have really let go by the wayside. We don't spend much time at all analyzing the things that we've read online. From the comfort of our own brains. Instead, it becomes very reactionary. It becomes a kind of a game of social capital to be passing ideas around constantly instead of stepping away and puzzling over those ideas.
And it also comes back on your innate resourcefulness or your developing your sense of resourcefulness, because we're all moving about a lot. As I said, we're leading very busy lives. We're also doing a lot of travelling and holidaying in different strange or crazy places. And you have a very funny story about, I think it was either London or Paris, and you were visiting an old school or college friend. And, you know, you'd got used to all the Google Maps and stuff like that. And you decided just to discover the city for itself and kind of nose about the place and just figure it out as you went along. And you describe a completely different visit to a city, and a city that you kind of knew, I suppose you kind of knew a bit, but that you saw it with completely different eyes because you weren't using, you know, MapsMe or whatever it is in your mobile phone, and you were just figuring it out. And surprisingly, you had a better time because there was more spontaneity.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so that part of the book I'm describing, navigating Paris with my smartphone versus an experience in London that I had when I was 20 years old, and there were no smartphones, so that sense of discovery that was possible when you were not just willing to get lost but expecting to get lost in a strange new place. The way that some geography people talk about this is allocentric versus egocentric ideas of the landscape. So an allocentric is that kind of bird's eye view that you get when you're looking down at a Google map. And egocentric is, of course, looking at the world through your own eyes. So seeing the children playing on the sidewalk, seeing, you know, smelling the cafe as you walk by it, that sensory-oriented, much less informed, but more curious, perhaps, idea of walking through a city. And, you know, the most exciting versions of travel probably include a combination of allocentric, that bird's eye view, and the egocentric, the kind of haphazard and curious experience.
One of the aspects of control, and I suppose how technology is pervading or hitting every aspect of our life, is on the e-jet industry. And it's something that you do go into quite a bit of detail on in the book. And it's funny, I found that chapter quite uncomfortable to read. I understand what everyone's doing. I understand why people are, I suppose, curating their lives and wanting to have something there after they die. But it makes for very morally and emotionally, I suppose is the best way to describe it, uncomfortable reading. And I'm just wondering, what was that like to research? Because you bring up some very interesting guys who've developed very interesting companies and have got a lot of investment in developing e-jet technologies and so on. But it's still, I wonder, it's all quite uncomfortable.
I mean, so the e-jet industry, which is sort of in some ways related to this idea of the singularity, it's trading on the idea that a temporal or mortal life is not actually necessary. That the death of humans, at the end of humans, and in fact the experience of grief that living humans have, all these things are sort of bugs in the system that need to be fixed. Right? That death is an engineering problem, and the solution tends to be the idea that you can in one way or another, you can upload your consciousness or upload yourself to the cloud, to a computer of some kind, and that therefore you can live in perpetuity. This gets enacted in different ways, but that's the basic idea, and I think that the thing that's missing there is a kind of definition difference. There's a very big difference between recall and memory. So if you think of what a computer is very good at is recall, right? It will show you the thing that you plugged into it, basically, or it will run the thing through an algorithm and give you the exact answer. This is what Picasso said, right? Computers are boring because they can only give you answers. But a human life is full of questions much more than it is answers. A human life is not about recall. It's about memory. It's about a very changing and metaphorical experience that I can't imagine human experience actually being put into a computer, because we don't want immediate recall. We want something that's constantly shifting and curious and is intangible on some level. So I've spoken with a few people about this, philosophers and some people at the Singularity University down in California, and I still haven't heard anybody describe an experience of e-death that sounds anything like a human life to me. It sounds basically like a recording of a human life.
I suppose we're all grappling with issues around consciousness to some degree, and our understandings and awareness and all of that type of stuff. But maybe it's a generational thing, and I think for me it's a moral thing primarily, that I find all of that very creepy, but I also find it very indulgent and very very unnecessary. You know, so when you met these different, you met some very successful entrepreneurs, I think some of them were from Eastern Europe, and, you know, very switched on guys, had a lot going and a lot going on in their heads. But I wonder, there's a kind of a mushrooming in the business of e-jet industry, and you take that on to greater questions and greater asks of ourselves, humanity and technology. What sort of a world will we be living in? Do you know, what becomes the primary focus, the life or the curated life? And that's all very murky.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think the e-death industry is a sort of extreme version of something that you're seeing all across the board, right? This is in some ways totemic of the Silicon Valley experience in general, right? That life is a problem that needs to be fixed, and that productivity levels can always be advanced. And in some ways, we're we're still extending that myth of the Industrial Revolution, right? That that human lives are things that need to be utilized, that need to be maximized. And this is not to say that in any way that, that I'm anti-technology, but it's really, Melvin Kranzberg had this idea, or this great line, he said, technology isn't good or evil, but neither is it neutral, right? I feel very strongly about that, that as we see these new technologies or new Silicon Valley-oriented philosophies coming down the on us, it's not that they're bad ideas or good ideas. It's just that we need to have balance in our lives, and that, you know, the knife in your kitchen is not a good or a bad thing, but it's also not neutral either, right? It's a dangerous and beautiful tool, and I think that's the best we can say for our smartphones and for our Twitter accounts. These are danger and beautiful tools that we need to learn how to use better.
I was very interested, Michael, in your research on depression, and some of it was very surprising and almost counterintuitive. But you know what I mean? I suppose that's the beauty of research. You visited Oregon Health and Science University, and they've conducted a lot of research into the impact of communications and technology on people's levels of depression, and whether it's, you know, the amount of text messages they receive or phone calls. And it's very surprising results. Can you tell me about it?
Right. Well, I mean, what we're finding, not just that study, but studies across the board, is that becoming the most connected humans in history has had no positive effects on levels of loneliness. If anything, we're actually more lonely than we were before. And, you know, and this was such an important revelation for me when I began working on this book, that it turns out that the cure for loneliness is not more company. Right? The cure for loneliness is learning how to be alone. And I think this is a big mistake that we're all making together. When you're lonely in a grocery store lineup for 20 seconds, instead of spending that time daydreaming or thinking about a loved one, we dive into our phone because we can't handle even a little bit of it. And you know, I think most mental faculties require a kind of exercise, very much so when it comes to spending time alone. We have to practice spending time alone. It will feel uncomfortable at first, but it's something that you get better at, and there are benefits. It's just like going to the gym. It feels horrible the first few times you do it.
But it is surprising that so many people are scared of a bit of time to reflect or silences, whether it's in conversation, whether it's at, you know, at parties or even in the workplace. We're all expected to chit-chat the whole time. And when you do just shut up in front of somebody or just kind of patiently listen, some people can get very distracted by that because there's almost an expectation to keep on going.
We're terrified of absolutely. I mean, this is why everybody text messages while they drive, right? Because when you're driving, you're in your car, and you start to have that scary feeling of oh my God, I'm spending time in my own head. The deep darkness is going to come and get me. So you have to dive into your phone. It doesn't matter that you're going to run over someone and kill them. The loneliness of your own company is worse than the threat of killing somebody on the road. I think that tells you all you need to know about how much we hate being alone, how much we hate quietude. There's a technique in journalism. I used to write quite a bit of newspaper and magazine stuff. And if you ask someone a question that they're not answering straight, if you just leave a moment of silence there, most people will crack within 10 seconds and just spill all the information that you want. Because, again, it is better to tell all your secrets than to have to live in a moment of quiet, right?
Tell me, you bring up David Eger's book, The Circle, which is a phenomenally intense read. And it's mm-hmm. But it's a very interesting read because it's so challenging on, you know, thinking things through and the development of whether it's technology, surveillance, whatever it is. What did you make of it?
I mean, I love Dave Eggers' work. I always have. That book, The Circle, I'm not sure what year it came out exactly, but I think it was at least a decade ago now. When it came out, I remember people not being too excited about it. But then they became more excited, I think, because some of the stuff that it's a dystopian future, but not too far off where we are now. And I think we're getting closer and closer to the world he imagined. And so people are starting to become more excited by that novel nowadays, I think, than when it first came out. It might have been a bit ahead of its time. In fact, there's now a film version of it as well. I've been always in love with dystopian novels because they really are our best windows into the future. Often, 1984, Brave New World. You know, these are all books that are like time machines for me. They show us something about where we're headed.
Thank you.
Talking Books on Newstalk 106 to 108.
And you're very welcome back to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. Well, on tonight's show, I'm talking with Canadian writer and journalist Michael Harris about his latest book, Solitude, In Pursuit of a Singular Life in a Crowded World, where Michael argues we should remind ourselves that a life without solitude is a diminished life. I asked Michael, why is it that most people can open up about their private lives, their sex life, their family complications, even their fancy money in the bank? But for some reason, when it comes to loneliness, well, most of us rarely admit to feeling it.
Isn't that interesting? I think people are very comfortable telling you how busy they are, right? But not comfortable at all telling you how lonely they are. At the end of the day, we are very much social animals. Social grooming is where, on that primal level, kind of instinct to groom each other, that's really hardwired into us. And so you're right when you say it could be a taboo, because to not be socially grooming, that must feel very wrong to those animal instincts buried inside us, right? To admit to not being part of a constant group. Exile is the ultimate tragedy for an animal in a social group. So to admit loneliness, to admit that even in a city of 10 million people, you don't feel connected to other people, that's one of the hardest things to admit, I think, even though it is something that, behind closed doors, most of us have experienced at some point.
Do you think technology is to blame, or is it maybe the fact that we're living very scheduled lives? Because, you know, I pop into some of my elderly neighbours on my road from time to time. But I do with all my close female friends. I schedule, so to speak, you know, whether it's texting or calling. You don't just impromptu anymore turn up on somebody's house for dinner and just expect to be served dinner. Do you know what I mean? With friends or family, we're all like planning in advance. And maybe we're kind of applying kind of business methods to our socializing, so that if you're feeling lonely, you know, you can't just, well, you can, but you, it's kind of socially awkward if you just drop into somebody's house unexpected, because we're all living in these planned, organized times. So it's almost seen as rude. The kind of spontaneity and social spontaneity stuff has got to that level of it's perceived to be as rude. Whether it's maybe in my parents or my grandparents' time, do you know what I mean? Granted, there was no smartphones and internet and all the rest, but people just casually just rocked into people's houses or had dinner or just even sat in each other's houses and didn't get up to much. But now we all have to have a thing to do when we're socialising rather than just hanging out.
And, you know, the kind of sustenance that somebody can get from a house visit versus a string of text messages, I mean, there's no comparison, right? To feel really at home in a friend's company, that's the kind of thing that you can live off for a week. But instead, yes, we've convinced ourselves that a fast food version of sociality, a fast food version of connection, is what we're going to feed ourselves. So instead of popping in on someone else in a hyper organized world like you described, the only thing that you can do is send a text message or hope that somebody will like a photo you posted on Instagram. But that's a pretty meager form of emotional nourishment, I would say.
Michael, you headed off with yourself for a week's self-imposed silence, and it was a lovely end to the book, and you packed all your food rations, so to speak, and you had kind of a plan for each day. And I think it was quite funny to read, you know, the different plans and expectations and epiphanies that you thought you would have didn't materialise. But can you tell me about that week? Because you left your partner and you were used to living with your partner and all the kind of the stuff that you usually bring with you into a day, and just were in a cabin for a week.
I was dreading that week But, you know, you're writing a book about solitude. You have to, at some point, you've got to walk off and do the Thoreau thing, right? And sit in a cabin on your own. The book is not really about becoming a hermit at all. It's about experiencing solitude from within a crowd, from within cities, actually. But I did want to have that experience in the mix. So eventually, near the end of my research, I did have to go off and spend 1 week alone at a cabin. And, you know, when you tell people that you spent 1 week alone, it doesn't at first sound like very much. People aren't really impressed by it. But then if you ask them to think to themselves, when was the last time you actually spent 24 hours with no human connection, no phone call, no email, no television, no dogs, no friends or seeing people out the window, no social connection at all. Most people can't think of a time in their lives when they spent 24 hours in complete isolation. So it turns out that spending a week like that is actually a real challenge to any kind of a super connected 21st century person. So I was terrified going into it. And as you say, you know, I thought maybe there would be some sort of magical epiphany that would be granted me at the end of all this work. But really, it was something much quieter than that. It was a kind of maybe a return to my childhood mentality, I think, a kind of pre-internet or a vacation in my pre-internet mental life.
And how did you find readjusting to a very busy, loud, super organized life? I know I did a month silence on a Buddhist retreat a couple of years ago, and I usually would do about week silences from time to time. And I can remember taking a couple of days before I re-immersed myself and, you know, and all the rest. And I was dying to talk to my twin sister and missed her terribly. But at the same time, I found it as scary coming out as going in. And that can be very surprising, can't it?
Oh, I mean, it can be a huge shock. I mean, after finally getting used to your own company, to be suddenly surrounded by humans chattering and screaming and jostling again, it's a real rude awakening for sure. The cabin that I was staying at was on a fairly low population island, and even just taking the ferry back to the mainland, I really was like the hermit in the woods who didn't understand how to interact with other humans. It was incredible how quickly my brain had stretched into a new shape.
Tell me, do you think, Michael, there's a middle way in all of this in terms of, you know, being able to appreciate the joy and inspiration and creativity that comes with bouts of solitude, as well as living an organised and busy and connected life? Like, do you think we can find within ourselves, and I suppose there's a different map and plan for everybody, but that there can be a middle ground, that you don't need to be a Buddhist monk or a super connected blah, 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 to just, you know, take a bit of time and space within any day or week or month to reflect and to have some peace within solo moments?
Absolutely. I mean, that's really the goal of the book, is to encourage people not to become hermits, but to think about the balance of their days, to think about the diet, the mental diet of their lives. Instead of just allowing, in particular, our technologies to crowd out every moment of silence or solitude that we might stumble upon, to say, actually, this is something that I insist on. I insist on an hour every day of time alone with my book or time alone walking on this trail. It's something that we've somehow convinced ourselves we don't need or is not part of a healthy life. And I think that's a very naive stance that we've taken. So my hope is that future generations are going to be less naive about their relationship with technology than we are, and will insist upon a healthy media diet in the same way that we now are more likely to insist on a healthy food diet.
You end the book, Michael, on a very upbeat and romantic note, which was lovely to read. And, you know, you bring up so many serious questions and ideas and a lot of heavy duty research throughout the book. But it was nice at the end, you know, a nice, hopeful, romantic note. Can you tell me about it? I think it was a revelation you had coming back off the island and the hut about your partner.
Yes. So after the week alone in the cabin, I come back to my apartment where I live with my partner, and you know, in that moment I realize that this is the man that I want to marry, and I think you know the reason that romantic revelation is what ends the book is because I wanted to underline for people for readers. That's what solitude is really about. It's not about disconnecting from humanity. Building a rich interior life is actually the key to connecting in a more meaningful way with other people. That's really the golden secret of solitude that you only find out on the other end, that taking that time for yourself is what's going to allow you to become a connected, three-dimensional human on the other side.
That was Canadian writer and journalist Michael Harris. Solitude in Pursuit of a Singular Life in a Crowded World is published by Random House and retails for in around €19 in hardback or a few quid less on a Kindle. Well, that's it for Talking Books for another week. I hope you enjoyed the show. Okay, all that's left for me to do now is to say a big thank you to Simon McGuire, who helped out with this evening's programme, and the lovely Lee Duncan on sound. We've been Talking Books. I'd like to end tonight's broadcast with the compelling words of Michael Harris from Solitude, where Michael concludes, "Is there no middle road? A way to secure some isolation within the glory of all that connectivity? Is there not a way to get past Lindbergh's starfish problem, where essential parts of ourselves are ripped off each time we enter and exit our solitude? Is there a third way that each person alone could discover for themselves?" Thought-provoking words indeed. Good night.
Talking Books on News Talk 106 to 108.